Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to Off the Charts, the podcast that brings you in-depth analysis and insights on one OTC-listed company each week. I'm your host, Phil Carroll, and joining me are my co-host, Kevin Hornsby, and our resident analyst and investor, Charles Archer. Together, we'll explore the exciting world of emerging companies and the opportunities they present. Welcome, gents.
Good morning.
How's things going?
Good morning, Vietnam.
you excited about Off the Charts then?
I'm incredibly excited. It's going to be super fun.
That's as excited as Charles ever sounds, by the way, just to let you know. I'm very excited. I'm very excited to put our thoughts to another audience in the United States of America and all those OTC clients, over-the-counter clients, which encounters many companies, obviously, from all over the world. Our focus is going to be primarily on ones that are listed in the UK or have connections in the UK in some way, shape, or form, as well as Canadian companies, Australian companies, etc., etc. So, yeah, looking forward to it very much.
Very good. So, to tell me, Charles, what do you look for when investing in a company, and what benefit do you see in having a dual listing, as I suppose an exposure to the US in the form of an OTC listing?
Well, when I'm looking just investing in general, there's a few things you want to look for. The first is management, right? The people at the top is the number one thing. Do you trust them? Do they have a good track record? When you're having a conversation with them, are they open and honest, as they can be? And second is obviously finances. What's the balance sheet like? Are they going to need to raise capital? How easily have they raised it in the past, et cetera, et cetera. In terms of a dual listing, the main benefit is obviously is having two potential audiences that could invest in your company, which is why the OTC market is so great, because it's such an accessible way for companies listed in London to get access to that American audience, especially companies in biotech sectors or junior resource, which tend to be a little bit higher risk. UK investors can be more reticent about investing in these sectors, but Americans have more of a can-do attitude, don't they? They have a more of a, you go for it, you take our risk money and you go make us rich, versus the UK, where it seems to be that a lot of investors are like, we'll just buy our dividend stocks and get our 9% a year. Americans are like, no, we want 100% a year. Let's make it happen.
Yeah, and what do you think of the valuations of them as well? I know that the stocks are fungible, and effectively it's an electronic transfer, you know, buy in the US and you see the trade go through in the UK. But how do you see the valuations of some of these, maybe the pharmas and biotech companies in the US compared to the UK?
Well, obviously, if biotechs, for example, that are listed in the US tend to have a valuation premium over the UK. And a lot of that is just a function of infrastructure. So if you go to like Boston in America, they have so much wet lab space that biotechs there can grow really, really quickly. Whereas in the UK, you've got limited space. So we have great startups, but then they have to escape to America. Often they pursue an OTC listing and then go to America permanently just to, you know, grow faster. Interestingly, though, if you look at companies that are listed in the UK and then they've got an OTC listing, or they might be dual listed on the ASX, often you'll find that there's a valuation gap in that the stock can be worth more on a different market overnight or different trading hours. Simply because it appeals more to different audiences. So, but I don't know. I think that it tends to be that those gaps close the larger a company grows.
Yeah, I think there's very different psyches, isn't there, in terms of the different markets, and I suppose that's one of the things we're going to be looking at as well in terms of this podcast, from a US perspective and a UK perspective. And yeah, the UK has been risk off for a long time, really, and a number of years. And I suppose we bring this to you as the American public, that if you saw some of these assets on the US market, you wouldn't believe the valuations in terms of how lowly valued they are compared to what you're able to buy on your own market, your home market. So, that's what we're trying to do. We're going to open the doors to you, listening to the CEOs, as Charles has said, who's in charge makes a big difference. The finances obviously make a big difference. And really the blue sky thinking about where these things can go makes a big difference. Now, if those things are backed up with the risk capital that you can put into these companies, then, you know, the sky is the limit. What would be missing in the UK is that blue sky thinking and the risk capital that is able to be put in there. So, yeah, OTC listing, a lot of the UK companies are going there to get liquidity, to show their wares. And a lot of the companies that we'd be dealing with will be resource-based companies. And I think the same applies in Canada as well. And we're going to be talking with some Canadian companies as well as we go along as well. So yeah, should all be very interesting, exciting. We hope to have some fun and laughter along the way. This isn't a serious podcast in terms of no jokes allowed. So if you don't get the English humor, we apologize initially, but we'll try and get as many translations in as possible in terms of the jokes.
Well, let's talk of jokes. Let's have a look at some of the politics on your side of the pond. So the first one I want to look at is the televised 90-minute debate between Trump and Biden. During a CNN presidential debate in Atlanta, Georgia, Donald Trump and Joe Biden addressed various issues, including the economy, abortion, and taxation. BBC Verified fact-checked several claims made during the debate. Did you see any of this debate at all?
Yeah, I watched the whole thing. It seems pretty simple, which is, you know, I don't know, we don't want to alienate all of the audience straight away, but we've got Biden, who is clearly mentally not competent of running the country. And I think that's very clear to everybody, regardless of voting intentions. But you've also got Trump, and every other thing he says is just not true. You know, demonstrably not true. Not just stretching the truth, just not true. Your choices are between somebody who's mentally not capable and somebody who's a liar, which, you know, doesn't sound great with a two-party system in the US. Ideally, it'd be great if both parties would replace the candidates with better people. I think Biden might get replaced before we get to the election. I think Trump, though, will be retain the Republican nomination.
He's not actually been nominated, has he, Biden, yet? He's not the official...
No. Well, I think it's in August, isn't it? There's a convention. So they do still have time to course correct. The problem is, obviously, if they replace Biden now, not only will they have to admit that he wasn't capable, you know, for a good few years, they'll also have to find somebody with like a brand recognized name, because that gives you a huge political advantage. And I can't think, you know, Kamala Harris maybe, but I can't think of anybody in the Democrat Party that will appeal to centrist voters who are kind of like wavering in the middle, and those are the people that determine who wins the presidency.
Has there ever been a more divided time in, I mean, obviously not in our lives, but that you can think of in, say, the last century in the US in terms of politics, in terms of, and also the division in the country itself?
Well, I'm obviously, however, there's been a civil war in America. It's a young country, you know, it's only been around for 250 years or so compared to the UK, where we've been going strong for 1,000+. And so, you know, you say, oh, has it ever been so divided? But I mean, actually, you know, there are people alive today whose grandparents were slaves. There's this idea that the US is incredibly divided is possibly not fair. It's a huge number of states, all of which have, you know, completely different geographies, opinions, peoples, religions. If you look at Texas, that's the size of France, Spain, and Germany put together alone, right? And so you're looking at this and you're going, oh, you know, they're so divided. I think that Americans are, yes, politically, maybe they are divided. But the average American just trying to get on in life, which is 85-90% of the population, is just, you know, getting on with their day. And then the 10% of people who are politically supercharged are at polar opposites. But I think it's the same in the UK, you know. I think, you know, we probably all have, like different political opinions. But we're all, you know, we could all go to the pub and have a drink and, you know, they wouldn't matter. Whereas it seems to me that, you know, you just have this audience in the US where, you know, a small proportion of people are incredibly politically motivated, and that's central to their personal ideology. You know, I only really worry or think about politics every 4 years when there's an election, and that's pretty much it. And I'm sure most people in the UK are the same, because otherwise you can't really affect it. And potentially in America, it's because you have so many votes at such different levels, whether it's state or county, or, you know, the presidential election or the by-elections every couple of years. And then just votes on like all sorts of referendums and all sorts of things, you know, whether it's cannabis reform or water reform or whatever else. So it might just be that just politics is just more ingrained into the psyche than we have over here.
I mean, we saw the recent, I don't know if you saw the news, but it was released on Monday that the Supreme Court ruled granting former president broad immunity for the official acts while in office. which is obviously expected to significantly impact the 2024 Biden-Trump rematch by reducing Trump's time in the courtrooms this autumn. The conservative-dominated court's decision means the lower court judges must now distinguish between Trump's official and unofficial acts, delaying potential trials. While Trump praised the ruling as a constitutional victory, Biden's campaign argued it empowers Trump to pursue retribution against political enemies. This ruling, seen as a boost for Trump's campaign by minimizing legal distractions, has intensified the stakes for voters who value democracy and accountability. So what are your thoughts on that news?
Legally, I think the Supreme Court have got it right. Okay, and the idea of the Supreme Court, even though it's not objective, because except Trump appointed a couple of, or even three of the justices, didn't he?
Really?
Yeah. So, you know, he only managed to, that ruling potentially is a reward for those appointments. But then again, not everything that he's wanted has gone his way on the Supreme Court, despite those appointments. I do think that, you know, legally that was the correct decision. But this is potentially a problem in the American Constitution, the separation of powers between the executive, legislative and judicial. The Supreme Court has a significant amount of power that potentially it shouldn't have. Potentially that kind of decision should have gone back to the legislature. But, you know, for example, in the UK, yes, we do have a Supreme Court, but and we do have an executive branch in the form of Prime Minister, but actually it's the legislature, like the House of Commons, that decides everything. And I guess, you know, when the American Constitution was set up, the idea was that having all of the power in one branch of government was a bad idea, so they split it all out into three. And what that means is that there's constantly a war effectively of power between the different branches of state. And I would say what it means is that it's harder to concentrate power in one area, but you do get very strange decisions like this that crop up occasionally. And also it makes it harder to get anything done, including reform, but such as life trade-offs.
Okay, so let's move on to our guest this week, kicking off with a company that's been making waves in the mineral exploration sector. We're thrilled to introduce Guardian Metal Resources, trading under the ticker GMTLF. Recently, Guardian Metal Resources upgraded from the OTCQB to the OTCQX market, marking a significant milestone in its growth journey. Guardian Metal Resources, formerly known as Golden Metal, focuses on exploring tungsten, copper, silver, gold, and lithium in Nevada, USA. We're delighted to have Oliver Friesen, CEO of Guardian Metal Resources, joining us today to discuss their recent upgrade to their OTC listing, the company's name change, and the exciting operational and corporate developments on the horizon. Welcome, Oliver, to Off the Charts.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me, gents. That's a great intro and a good overview of what we're doing here, Phil, so I appreciate that.
Not a problem. So just give the listeners a little lowdown on what Guardian Metals does and the various assets within its portfolio, please, Oliver.
Yeah, of course. So you mentioned kind of a plethora of different commodities that we're focused on. But what I really would want to probably highlight here is our angle towards tungsten. Now, tungsten is a metal that, you know, the listeners may or may not have come across, but it's one that I'm sure they will start to come across more and more as the prevalence of that commodity and really how important that commodity is for the United States national security really starts to come into the picture. Now, behind the scenes, tungsten is a metal that is being talked about frantically. There's a lot of reasons for that, main one being the fact that China controls about 86% of total global supply. So there's a very, you know, short list of commodities and metals that China has, you know, call it an 85% plus market share. And tungsten is very firmly on that list. And then one of the biggest use cases of tungsten at the moment, and it's no surprise given geopolitical tensions where they are, is the fact that tungsten is used extensively within defense. You know, it's a key component in things like the manufacturing of ammunitions alongside antimony and other few select metals. It's used also in tank armors, and there's a long list of sort of direct defense applications. So what's brewing here in the tungsten space, it's a little bit scary. I'm not going to lie in the fact that, you know, the need to reshore metals is the theme is probably picking up steam more so than ever. And the fact that the United States and really the Western world is just so reliant on China for tungsten and for a metal that goes directly into the defense, it really highlights this position that needs to change. And I think what that really does is it shines a light on Guardian Metal Resources, which, you know, is the fact that we own what's believed to be the largest undeveloped tungsten deposit on U.S. soil. And just a takeaway point here is if you want exposure to made in America U.S. tungsten, Guardian Metal Resources is the only publicly traded company that you can get access through, period.
Love that, made in America. You can imagine coming out of the ground with stamp on it, made in America, and all the embossed, you know.
Absolutely. No, I mean, it's such an important theme right now. And when you consider the fact that, you know, we have an LOI offtake agreement with a company called Global Tungsten Powders based out of Pennsylvania, what that means is that, you know, if and when we can get this project into production, which is our goal, you know, the tungsten concentrate comes directly out of the ground in Nevada, the most mining friendly place in the entire world. It goes on rail car to Pennsylvania, where they process the concentrate and produce usable tungsten products. And then that tungsten stays in the U.S. It goes towards the contractors that need it. I mean, what a great story. And what an important thing to push forward here in 2024, where we need to reshore and support made in America, made in the Western world again. And Guardian Metal fits perfectly into that theme. And we're very aligned to that very important trend right now.
Okay, Oliver. So, you are of Canadian descent. Here we are in the United States of America. And basically, just to remind people, all of your assets are in the US, effectively. You are a US-based company that is listed on the UK stock market. Tell us a little bit about the story of your listing. Obviously, you listed on my birthday a year and a half ago or a year and a few months ago. Tell us the story from the beginning to now. What has happened?
Yeah, of course. Well, you mentioned my Canadian accent there, Kevin, so I'll just quickly touch on that. A lot of people actually confuse me for an American when they first hear me talk.
Tell me, how often, and is it worse to be an American confused as a Canadian or a Canadian confused as an American? Which is the most insulting? I always forget which one it is.
Depends whether you're Canadian or American,
comment.
I would imagine.
I don't want to answer that. But what I will say is I was actually...
Canadians are very polite, you see. They wouldn't answer that question, Phil.
I know for sure which one it is. I'm not saying.
Tim Hortons in his hand, and he's too polite to answer your question.
But yeah, no, I'm a geologist by trade myself. But I was born and raised in a town called White Rock, British Columbia, which is about 5 minutes from the American border. So I spent probably half of my childhood at the gas station in the grocery store in America because the groceries were cheaper there. So a strong connection and growing up and still to this day to the US. But so just on kind of who we are, Kevin, and what our story is. So yes, we are. Our primary listing is here in the UK in London. And the way that came about was moved here about 4 years ago and being really involved in the exploration space in Canada and the US. I used to actually live in Nevada and work for Barrick Gold. So it's a jurisdiction that is near and dear to my heart. But when I moved to London, which is obviously a major financial, London in particular, major global financial hub, and realized that there was very few great exploration and development names, and specifically those that focused on the world-class mining jurisdictions like Nevada. With my connections and used to, you know, my previous time living there, I thought, let's bring Nevada to the UK. I mean, what a great idea. What a jurisdiction that I think British people will want to get exposure to. And then, you know, we incorporated the business and within about a year we had, you know, Pilot Mountain came across my desk and I almost immediately was like, we need this asset. And I knew very little about tungsten at the time. And since we've acquired it, the narrative around tungsten, I mean, it's just gone parabolic, really. But even still, not many people are aware of it. I mean, people I know, as I mentioned, and behind the scenes, it's one of the hot button metals. And I'm sure after this podcast now where you've heard me talk about it, you'll start to see it pop up more and more. And potentially, you know, if China announced an export ban tomorrow on tungsten to the US, I mean, that would absolutely flip the script. But, you know, long and short of it is that asset came across my desk and I went, we need this thing. I want to build a company around this asset. And since then we've incubated the asset. But, you know, with all of our assets being in Nevada, and in particular, as I've mentioned earlier, the national security interest that our tungsten asset plays and the fact that it's the largest undeveloped tungsten deposit on US soil. The U.S. currently produces no domestic primary production of tungsten. I mean, what a fantastic metal to get exposure to. And as I mentioned, if you want tungsten exposure in the U.S., we are the only publicly traded company. So naturally, shortly after our listing here in the U.K., it became so clear after going on a few marketing kind of roadshows to the U.S. how important was that U.S. investors could get access and exposure to what we're doing here at Guardian Metals. So we listed on the OTC QB in the latter half of 2023, and then very quickly we're able to upgrade, which I think is a real sign as to the positive momentum the company has and has been building. But we're still early days. You know, we're really just getting started here in my view. There's so many catalysts upcoming. But yeah, we uplisted to the OTC QB, which I think once again highlights the value of what we're doing here in momentum. And now it's really about, you know, all my marketing efforts have really shifted to the US and going on roadshows and trying to get this story to the masses, because, you know, with the potential for Department of Defense grant support, the national security, I mean, I could go on and on and on as to why this is so important in America. But now with this podcast and really trying to get this story out and evangelize about the importance of tungsten and Guardian Metal to the U.S. population.
So, Oliver, what percentage of the world's tungsten comes out of China as we speak?
Yeah, so the top four producers of tungsten worldwide, I mean, this is the who's who in the zoo. Number one is China, as I mentioned, which is 86%. The next three biggest names, you're probably going to guess what two of them are. Well, it's Russia and North Korea. And then Vietnam.
Lovely friendly jurisdictions.
Absolutely. I mean, name a commodity where those three countries are on the top four list. And then Vietnam's in there, which is obviously a friendlier country. But all tungsten that is mined out of Vietnam, or most of it, stays in Asia, where a lot of it is used. So yeah, it's China. And then I think number two is Russia, three Vietnam, and four North Korea. So
proportion of the U.S. defense industry uses tungsten then? You know, the world's production on an annual basis, how much of that do they actually use?
Yeah, so tungsten has a wide array of use cases. When I first say tungsten, kind of our grandparents' generation, so to say, the usage was in tungsten filaments and light bulbs. That is completely gone away. Tungsten is such a fantastic metal because it has the highest melting point and it's one of the most dense metals on the planet. So it makes it almost irreplaceable in modern technology. And, you know, there's a long list of brand new power installations, nuclear fusion, energy transition, major energy transition use cases of tungsten are popping up almost weekly now. If you Google tungsten, you know, there'll be 10 fusion articles about the importance of that metal. But on the defense use cases, as I mentioned, it's one of the key components of ammunitions. Tungsten has been used in ammunitions for many, many, many decades. Actually, very interestingly enough, Pilot Mountain are 100% owned asset. There's an open pit there, a relatively small open pit that was mined most recently in the 40s and 50s, and was actually the tungsten from that open pit was very important towards supporting the United States war efforts during World War II. So I think it really highlights the historic nature of this asset and how important a role it's played previously. But tungsten is still used in ammunition to this day because of the components and the chemical makeup, as I mentioned, and that's not going away.
It's irreplaceable, isn't it, Oliver? I mean, it's irreplaceable. This is the thing. With copper, copper is, you know, sort of irreplaceable, but you can replace it with aluminium. It's, you know, only got about 60% of the conductivity, but you can do it. If you've got a lithium ion battery, you can replace lithium ion with sodium in some applications, or vanadium. But with tungsten, it can't be replaced. It can't be manufactured artificially. It's kind of tricky to recycle. And therefore, it just has much better economics in terms of economic moat around the metal compared to other elements. Would you say that's probably true?
Yeah, you absolutely nailed it, Charles. And that's such an important consideration, is because you see these boom and bust cycles, and we'll loop back to the use case within defense. But you see these boom bust cycles, and, you know, lithium just went through one and cobalt went through one. Because what happens is there's a huge amount of hype. Oh, we're going to need this amount of cobalt for batteries for electric vehicles. Well, yeah, the price gets so high, and then what's the cure for high prices? Well, you know what happens next. It comes down because the manufacturer said cobalt's too expensive. We're going to replace it with something else that's cheaper.
Exactly.
Tungsten is irreplaceable in so many of these technologies because there's no other metal with the same or similar melting point as well as density. It just doesn't exist. So when it comes to nuclear fusion, which is a huge use case that's coming out here, you know, I looked my fusion specialist in the eye and I said, well, The amount of tungsten required in fusion that you're telling me is going to put the most unbelievable strain on the tungsten prices and will cause a huge surge that will never come down. I said, they're going to find a replacement for tungsten. He looked me in the eye. He said, the one metal that will never, ever be replaced in nuclear fusion is tungsten. And this is actually a gentleman who has a PhD in tungsten. And that's what he told me. So just to loop back to your original question, Phil, or maybe Kevin, it's about 10% of tungsten that's consumed globally right now goes towards defense. A lot of that is tungsten carbides and all these other kind of use cases. But what's interesting is the usage of tungsten within the defense is growing, as you can probably guess, is growing astronomically year over year. From 2022 to 2023, tungsten usage within defense alone was up 23%. That was in 1 year. We don't have the 2023 to 2024 numbers, but I anticipate it's going to be at least that, if not more. So we're seeing massive increase of usage in tungsten within the defense base, as you probably guessed why. Well, the ammunition stockpiles in the U.S. are very, very low, and there's the need to ramp up the manufacturing of ammunitions, of tanks, of all these different kind of important defense technologies, and tungsten is used in all of them. And then when just to kind of tie a bow around it, when you consider the fact that the majority of the United States tungsten comes from China, well, there you go, game over, right?
It does feel to me like the U.S. is, you know, the government has shot itself in the foot a little bit. You know, maybe you can contextualize this better than me. But there used to be a massive stockpile of lots of critical minerals, including tungsten. You know, the tungsten stockpile was worth $42 billion back in 1952, just after the Second World War. That's inflation adjusted. And now it's worth less than $1 billion. They sold it all off. And then on top of that, from January 2026, unless I'm mistaken, the US Department of Defense is banning the import of tungsten from China, as well as Russia, North Korea, and Iran. So regardless of whether there's an export ban, not only do they not have enough tungsten in the stockpiles, they're banning the import from the major producers. It seems like you're in the perfect spot, but politically, have they made a misstep?
Yeah, I would say we're in the perfect spot is almost an understatement. But like you mentioned, all those data points. So I'll add another one. The United States is imposing 25% tariffs on all tungsten from China in August 1st. So less than a month from now, all Chinese imports will have 25% export ban on them. Have they shot themselves in the foot? I wouldn't put the U.S. on kind of blast here. What I would say is the Western world has shot ourselves in the foot. And maybe it's China and Russia who've sort of lulled us into this false sense of confidence in that, hey, we can just rely on China and Russia for all of these metals because we don't want to mine them in our own backyard. You know, we'd rather it happens overseas and we get the product and everything's great. And this sort of this whole NIMBY, not in my backyard contagion, really, that's spread across the Western world. And in Canada, it's no different. You know, the industry has done a bad job in marketing the importance of mining. So what that means is that it's just been hard to garner support for great projects like this, which is why, you know, it never was put into production. The support wasn't there. And, you know, at the time, everyone just said, well, China's producing it. We'll just let them do it and they'll send it to us. And that will be a great solution until it's not. Until right now, where all of a sudden, you know, it's clear now that China is starting to weaponize these things and Russia is starting to weaponize these things. So, you know, like you mentioned, the situation is the buildup and all these data points, you add them together, all signs point to tungsten and all signs point to Guardian Metal as the owners of this asset. So yes, you mentioned very, very importantly, the DLA stockpiles are critically low or almost depleted now. And that was a really well thought out, federally funded program. I can't remember when it came in. I think it was around the Vietnam War, where the government said, hey, let's build stockpiles of all these important metals because there might be a time in the future where we can't rely on China and Russia and all these other unfriendly adversaries for these important metals. And I think, and I need to double check this, but I believe it was in 2010 during the Obama administration where they actually reversed course and said, you know what, this is silly. We have all these warehouses in upstate New York and Virginia and around the US where these stockpiles of tungsten and other metals are just gathering dust. Let's sell them off. We don't need them anymore. You know, we can rely on our friends over there overseas for these metals. But that position changed in the wake of the Russia-Ukraine war. That position changed. So what that means now is what was meant to be a stockpile that the U.S. could tap into during times exactly like this. Well, they've gone to the warehouses and you open the door and it's almost empty. Which is, you know, a really scary situation. And I think really, once again, highlights the importance of made in America assets that Guardian Metal owns in our tungsten asset.
So Oliver, from a point of view of off the charts here, we're talking about off the charts. And how has your chart looked in terms of share performance over the last while? And what sort of market cap are we talking about in terms of your overall market cap in the United Kingdom at the moment?
Yeah, so... in terms of off the charts, I wouldn't say anything in our chart is off the charts. What I would probably highlight, or the main takeaway from our share price performance, is it's been a nice sustained build. There's not any kind of funny big spikes up that usually fall back on the other side. No, our share price since our IPO has been a nice sustained build up. And it's, you know, there's probably a lot of reasons for that. We've been very thoughtful about who we position in this business. We have very large, very supportive shareholders out of the UK and the US who understand the opportunity that we have here. There's a lot of games in junior mining, and I'm sure a lot of the listeners who invest in the OTC and various names have seen a lot of horror stories where these names, you don't know what's going on behind the scenes. The management isn't aligned with shareholders. There's big spikes. There's funny buggers being played behind the scenes. And that can scare people away from the space, and understandably so. So I've been burned by names myself. But learning from those mistakes and learning from companies who've done it wrong, we have turned those lessons and effectively taken those learnings and said, let's do this the right way. Let's build this thing from scratch and let's get the right people involved, which could allow you to have really nice sustained performance. So yeah, we IPO'd and our share price has done well since then. But I think the main takeaway is, with all the catalysts that are upcoming here over the summer, with drilling ongoing, a lot of other commercial, really important commercial work streams that are on rails right now. You know, we're about, about a $35 to $40 million US market cap. But if you look at where we're going here, where we think we can go with the support we have and with the catalysts upcoming, you know, I really do think it's early days here. And there's a lot of work we need to do here, but there's a lot of excitement that's brewing here. And, you know, if we can execute on some of our main goals here, I think it's going to be a really exciting 12 months and you know, years ahead as we look to get this project from the position it's now to construction ready, with our ultimate goal of supplying tungsten to the U.S. market and being the only U.S. mine to do so. And that's a huge, huge goal, but it's one that we think is achievable with the team we have, with the setup we have, the backers we have, and the assets we have, which is most important. So really exciting times ahead, and I think it's a great time to get this story on people's radar.
Yeah, and the drill bit's turning as we speak, from what we understand there on Pilot Mountain. So just give us a bit of an indication of what people could expect to see and hear in the next sort of 6 months. And then just as a final sort of throwaway, give us your view on the other projects that you've got in the portfolio, because we've got potential gold and copper and lithium also, even though the main strike force at the minute is definitely tungsten. Yeah, give us your thoughts on that.
Yeah, so in terms of what investors can expect, I'll just touch on the technical bits here for now. There's obviously some commercial angles that we're pushing forward, and I encourage anyone listening to just go to our website and you know, look at our last handful of press releases, or go to our Twitter, where we're very active in talking about all the other potential commercial catalysts and what we're doing there. But just on the technical side, so, you know, being a geologist myself, I was in Nevada a few weeks ago getting things kicked off and working with our crews there. We have fantastic geophysics crews, fantastic geologists, fantastic drilling company. Most of them are based out of Nevada. They're all Nevada residents. So it's great to work with people who are in state, who understand how to operate in Nevada efficiently. As you mentioned, drilling is ongoing. We've completed two holes. We've put out a press release highlighting some visual results from those first two holes. Very, very exciting start to the program. We drilled into a porphyry, and some of the listeners might be aware what a porphyry is and how transformational those can be. But we're seeing really classic porphyry veining from surface down to 400 meters. So there's going to be a lot of news coming out of that. So we had some visual results. We have a porphyry specialist who's on site right now working with our crews. We're also doing geophysics right now. Actually, we just completed that as of last night, Pilot Mountain and Garfield. So a lot of drilling news. We'll certainly take center stage. But if listeners do go look at our website and look at our newsreel, you'll see how active we are and how active we've been over the last 14 months since we listed. And it's not fluff. I mean, these are real news releases with real quality information and real catalysts moving forward. So mostly drilling news, but geophysics as well. We're pushing forward FS on our tungsten deposit, so really focusing on the development angle there, but also making sure that we're exploring and looking to make new discoveries alongside that.
And we haven't even talked about the recent MOU with Oxford Sigma as well, which is obviously, I think, your most recent announcement. Just tell us how significant, because obviously you talked about the fusion and the reactors and the importance of tungsten, but just talk us through what that potential MOU could lead to, Oliver.
Yeah, of course. So, you know, really what we're trying to do here is we know we have such an important and valuable asset in hand in Pilot Mountain. And in particular, the tungsten deposit is called Desert Scheelite. So at Desert Scheelite, we have a huge opportunity there. And it's something that the U.S. really needs to get put into production. So we're looking to tap into as many tailwinds as we can to ensure that we have the support and we're doing all the right things to get that Desert Scheelite as close to production ready as possible. So that's kind of going on in the background. But the MOU that you mentioned, Phil, you know, our next step is, okay, well, we have the tungsten. Who's going to need it? Who are going to be the major kind of downstream users of our product? So as we mentioned, obviously, the DOD in the U.S. is a huge consumer of tungsten. So that's an obvious one that we want to push forward and find ways to be a supplier directly to the DOD through our offtaker. Now, we need to look into that more and have some further conversations, but that would be a fantastic outcome. We could be a supplier directly to the DOD, but the DLA as well, you know, they're going to be looking to build those stockpiles up. But as I mentioned earlier, probably the use case of tungsten that I'm most excited about longer term is in fusion. Now, nuclear fusion, not to be confused with nuclear fission. So fission is what, you know, the U.S. has right now. There's a lot of nuclear fission power plants using enriched uranium, which is a major supplier of energy in countries like Canada, in the U.S. The U.S. is ramping up our use of nuclear power. France is a huge, China, Russia, they all use nuclear power. Nuclear fission is fantastic. We need to build more of them. I'm a huge proponent of nuclear fission, but nuclear fusion is what's coming next. Now, this is the technology that is going to be probably the most important technologies, if not the most important technology, and specifically when it comes to energy in our lifetime. Massive, massive amounts of money are currently being deployed into nuclear fusion technology. And just for a very quick overview, and I'm not a nuclear fusion or physicist, I'm a lowly geologist, but you know, we've partnered with Oxford, who are, I think it's about 8 or 9 individuals, mostly, you know, very, very highly educated nuclear physicists and material science engineers. But effectively what nuclear fusion is doing or looking to do is harness the energy of the sun. We're creating that sun here on Earth, and then we're harnessing the energy. And the great thing about nuclear fusion is that it's effectively near limitless. These things will run for perpetuity, and it's carbon-free. There's no nuclear waste that's produced. So effectively, because of those key details, you know, countries like the U.S., U.S. is by far and away the world trailblazer when it comes to nuclear fusion technology. Because the country that can solve this technology first and commercialize it has a huge leg up in the global stage. And obviously, the United States being a global leader in so many different technologies, as you can imagine, is trailblazing and throwing billions and billions of dollars at nuclear fusion. And there's massive advancements being made almost weekly now. And the most recent advancement was on the back of lining the entire reactor with tungsten because of that melting point. So anyways, nuclear fusion, it's something that is going to take the world by storm. You know, Sam Altman is a name that probably many listeners are aware of. He just made one of his biggest personal investment bets in nuclear fusion. So it's not like it's a few niche people talking about fusion. It's people in the know are talking about fusion. And just to close the loop there, Phil, I know you're trying to cut me off because I'm probably rambling on. But to partner up with Oxford Sigma, who are probably one of the world's leaders in nuclear fusion material science, that's the key component here is they consult to these companies and help them with, hey, what metals are going to be needed here? And they came to us and said, guys, there's so much tungsten that's going to be needed here to line these walls. No one's talking about it. How can we work together to get this story out, which is what we're doing now?
So basically, if I'm right, and in my understanding, the fission reactors that you talked about, which are effectively nuclear fission, where you're effectively splitting them into smaller nuclei, which releases the energy, whereas the nuclear fusion that you're talking about is effectively trying to replicate the process of, you know, the powers the sun and the stars. It's almost like a limitless supply of energy.
Exactly. Yeah, you nailed it. Perfect.
Okay.
Oliver, you said it better than I did.
You're on off the charts now. So what we're going to ask you is, what is your favorite movie?
My favorite movie, it is, without a doubt, Shawshank Redemption.
Oh, very good.
Oh, very good choice.
Don't ruin the ending.
You need a box of hankies for that one. That's a tearjerker, isn't it?
Not really. It's just fascinating.
My second one, which is a bit maybe more rogue, is The Truman Show. Absolutely love that one.
Oh, Truman Show. Very good. And you've got to go on. We'll move on to the third one. Go and watch the third.
Oh, I've never thought about my third one. What else do I like? Anything Star Wars. I'm a bit of a Star Wars nerd. You might not have guessed that, but I do like the Star Wars. But Shawshank Redemption, number one, Truman.
I'm guessing Charles is a Star Wars nerd.
Not the most recent stuff, but, you know, they've put out a few
The older stuff.
I find the thing, Shawshank Redemption is just instant classic. Truman Show, I really loved, but I can never help but think, had they made that a horror film rather than a comedy film, it could have been even better. Interestingly, Tungsten used to be like instrumental in making films and movies, isn't it? Until they found new technology. And it's nice to see it swing back around to something even more useful, like limitless energy for the entire planet.
Exactly.
You know, hopefully all of it can help out with that.
Well, my favorite movie is A Few Good Men, and you can't handle the truth.
I'm sorry. The best films ever made is the original Lord of the Rings trilogy, Peter Jackson. Sorry, but no competition.
They're doing the start or the next generation.
The Finding of Gollum or whatever it's called. Yeah.
I've just noticed, though, gents, as three British guys, you're only referencing American movies. And I know it's mostly American listeners, but maybe what's the top British movie that Americans may or may not have heard of that you can recommend?
I think.
Are there no good movies out of the UK? I'm not sure.
Yeah, instantly that comes to mind is Four Weddings and a Funeral.
That's a chick flick. You can't talk chick flicks. Oh, you can talk chick flicks, but
I like chick flicks. They're good.
Really?
Yeah, I like chick flicks. Let's be honest.
It's like Silence
Americans
of the Lambs,
make most of the movies, don't they? Even though we do make some. What was it? Lock, Stock and Smoking Barrel? Three Smoking Barrels?
Well, Layer Cake or something. One of the Guy Ritchie movies. I mean, he's made some great movies over the years, Guy Ritchie.
Yeah. There you go. So there's a few.
Yeah. So if people want to invest in Guardian Metal Resources, how can they do it through the OTC market as an American investor?
Yeah, of course. I have to be careful about suggesting any investments. You know, everything that I've said today is just kind of my take on what we're doing here at Guardian Metal and really highlighting the importance of this story. But just, you know, we are traded on the OTCQX. As you mentioned, Kevin, our ticker is GMTLF. So that's, you can find more information on us if you go to our website, guardianmetalresources.com. We're very active on Twitter as well. So I encourage anyone who is interested in what we're doing, go to our website, go to our Twitter, do some more research. It's all out there. We're very active. We're, you know, a very communicative company. Reach out to me. If you email info@, you'll find the email on our website. I respond to those emails. We can set up a call. There's no position size too small. If you want to invest $500, call me. I'll have a chat. Let's talk through the story. And I love to talk to our investors and potential future investors. We're going to be doing lots of road shows in the U.S., getting this story out. It's such an important one for the U.S. We're so importantly aligned with national security interests at a time in 2024 where geopolitical tensions where they are. And it's so important to reshore these metals. And that's what we're looking to do here in the U.S., which is such an important story. So look us up, do more research, reach out. Let's chat.
Okay, on that note, we'll say Oliver Friesen, CEO of Guardian Metal Resources, thanks very much for your time.
Yeah, thank you so much, gents. I appreciate it.
So what do you think, Charles? I mean, we've obviously had a lot of dealings with Oliver in the UK, so give us your thoughts on sort of, he's obviously cannot tell you to invest, but why would you invest? Are you invested is a good question.
I am invested. I've been invested since the early days, you know, but just after the IPO, I was saying, look, this political storm around Tungsten is going to become critical over the next couple of years. You know, Oliver saw that, I saw that, a few of us saw that, and obviously we've done well, but we're still at the start of the story, right? The key thing is, you know, the stuff, you know, that I find really important is you need a domestic source of Tungsten. Because of the defense applications, it is critical that the US has its own domestic source up and running as soon as possible. You know, this the stockpile of tungsten that they have, I'll give you some context, right? The tungsten stockpile is less than $1 billion. The US has $3.5 billion worth of cheese in their strategic stockpile. So cheese is 3 times more valuable to the US than tungsten, apparently, at the moment, which is madness.
But, best analogy I've heard all week, that best analogy, the cheese analogy.
You can't eat tungsten, though.
Right, let's be honest. A nice piece of cheddar, still.
They keep trying to give away the government cheese. No one wants it.
Probably processed cheese, that's why.
Problem Swiss cheese, is it?
But, you know, the big thing for me, I said it at the start, and I'll repeat it, is the management, right? When you speak to Oliver, not on a podcast where obviously he has to be quite guarded and careful with what he says, but just in person or, you know, via a phone chat, you just get the impression that this is a person who you can trust, which is not always the case of everybody. But with Oliver, I think that you can. And when he says, this is what we're going to do, 3 months later, it's been done. It's not like we're going to do this over the next few months and then 3 years later, you're still waiting. The drive that he has to get this thing over the line is amazing. And I genuinely believe that, you know, this time next year, the stock will be a lot higher than what it is now. But more importantly, on a corporate level, it'll be far, far more developed. So, you know, we are potentially looking at some kind of US government grant funding in the near future. A lot of grants have already been applied for. And we're definitely going to get assays out from Pilot Mountain, potentially increasing the size and value of the resource. We're definitely going to see tungsten become ever more and more part of the mainstream discourse, just because whether it's nuclear fusion or defense applications or China, politically, it's a metal that is going to take center stage more and more. And again, as Oliver said, you know, and this is what I saw, you know, a year and a half ago, if you want to invest in a domestic source, as in a US source of tungsten, Guardian Metal is the only company that you have access to. It's as simple as that. It's not like you don't even have a choice. This is the only one that is available if you're a private investor. And it's as simple as that.
I would suggest that all of you Americans don't buy this share, okay? Because we want to keep all the profits ourselves in the UK. So
indeed,
you can have the tungsten, but basically we will keep all the profits. So good luck anyway. Have a look at it yourselves and come and buy the shares from us, basically, because that's what you're going to have to do. We are also shareholders. We've seen the story. We're impressed with Oliver. And more importantly, we're impressed with this asset. It keeps getting better and better and better, not just from a tungsten perspective, also from a copper perspective. We didn't even mention the fact that it has garnets that can be sold. We didn't even mention the fact that there's quite high grades of silver involved as well, because we didn't have time to go into all of that. But this is something that you should take some time and investigate. So good luck, everybody.
Okay, so let's have a look at the markets this week. I mean, the big news story for me was the fact that Nvidia, about a week ago, became the world's most valuable company with a market valuation of $3.34 trillion, obviously surpassing Microsoft. However, the Nvidia shares have obviously dropped back about 13 to 14% since then, reducing its valuation by a whopping $500 billion in that 13%. Obviously, factors contributing to the decline include profit taking by investors, naturally, speculative money moving to other stocks like Meta and Apple, and obviously an insider selling by key directors, including CEO Jensen Huang. Additionally, concerns about Nvidia's high price earnings ratio, PE ratio, which was 45 times the expected earnings compared to the S&P's 500's 22 times average, have obviously raised questions about whether the valuation is sustainable. So what do you make of it? I mean, it's been likened to this dot-com bubble, and obviously Cisco Systems overvaluation and subsequent decline. But what do you make of this whole AI, tech, Microsoft, Nvidia bubble right now?
Well, I think it is a huge bubble. But like all bubbles, I mean, if you talk about the dot-com bubble, yes, plenty of companies collapsed and lost all their money. Some of the big winners like Microsoft, Apple, Amazon, you know, made billionaires of the initial investors. So I suspect it'll be the same thing. A lot of these companies will collapse and there'll be a few winners. Will Nvidia be the winner of the AI? Potentially. But, you know, like a lot of people thought Yahoo was going to be the winner and then it was Google, right? A lot of people thought it would be pets.com and it was Amazon. So it's very easy to say, you know, this is different, this particular one. And yes, they've got a big economic moat around these particular microchips, and they can use the microchips to develop better microchips using AI. So potentially, you know, it's very difficult for anyone to steal their economic moat. Having said that, other companies do exist, and obviously where there's high pricing and big margins, there's an incentive to compete and to catch up. With Nvidia, yeah, I mean, you were saying the insiders selling, yes, Jensen Huang, the CEO, 120,000 shares in June, mid-June. But it wasn't only Jensen Huang, it was the executive vice president, Deborah Shoquist, She's all $45 million worth. And then Dawn Hudson, Tench Cox, John DeBeery, Michael McCafferty, Brooke Sewell, Mark Stevens, all these big names in the video. They're all selling at the top.
I mean, this is a company, Charles, that apparently were 30 days away from bankruptcy. I remember reading an article that Jensen Hung apparently sat his staff round, and it was all formed around like a meeting. I think it was at a Denny's restaurant in the US. Mm. And they were literally 30 days away from closing the doors. He sent out an email saying, we've got 30 days working capital.
Yeah, and that was that.
And do you know how, since the IPO in 1999, do you want to hazard a guess at how much that they've done in terms of percentage return?
No, like 100,000 or something. It's something insane.
591,000%.
Crazy. I mean, crazy. But this is the same with Apple, with Amazon, with all of these big companies. They're all on the verge of bankruptcy at one point. They were all penny stocks at one point because they all started somewhere, you know? But I think with NVIDIA in particular, there's two things that make me nervous. The first is we are in a bubble of AI. It's very over-exuberant, and the actual practical applications for artificial intelligence, I'm not entirely sure that that it's going to be as amazing as what people think it is. But the other problem is that virtually all of their microchips are made in Taiwan.
I knew you were going to say that. You can get them from TSMC.
Of course they do, from TSMC. And like some of the design are done by Arm or their company in the Netherlands, whatever it's called. But it doesn't matter. Let's say tomorrow, right, China follows through with its threats and it invades Taiwan. NVIDIA is worth almost nothing, IP.
You can't blame the board of directors from taking some money off the table, can you really?
No, not at all. Not at all. But I mean, also, they've made huge value creation. You know, like even if they've taken money off the table, if you'd invested at the IPO and you were complaining about them taking money off the table now, I think you've got to have a look at yourself. If you invested 6 months ago, you've made a small fortune. But it does seem to always track that when investors take a significant amount of capital off the table, in the CEO's case, maybe it's not fair because it's pocket change, really, and he still has a huge holding. But the other board members and the other senior figures who maybe aren't fabulously wealthy, that's more worrying, I think. Those smaller names you may not have heard of, but coming away and saying, right, we're going to take a little bit off. Again, almost all of them are retaining significant holdings anyway. So,
I think it's propelled Jensen Hung to something like the 11th richest man in the world now, isn't it? Something along those lines.
Yeah, well, he's got kind of the Elon Musk kind of fame almost, if he wanted to capitalize on it. And the reason why is all he does is work, right? Yeah. There's nothing wrong with that if that's what you love doing, because but he literally 24/7 every single day. 365 days a year he's working.
Yeah, I read something that he doesn't have a desk. He goes to the office and he literally moves around. He's constantly meeting and talking to people. He doesn't believe in sitting. He wants to be there for people and
I think he's got ADHD personally. I think he's literally he can't stop. I imagine that he's the kind of boss, forgive me, Justin, if you're listening, probably not, but if you are, the kind of boss who's literally just, starts something, says, right, get cracking on that. Wheels back in a month later, right? What are the problems? So we got back to it, and the people are like, what are you talking about? We didn't, but I don't know. He seems to know how to make money, the man, so that's the most important thing, right?
It is a shock, though. Someone else on the spectrum, not in the business world,
yeah.
But then, do you know, I mean, it makes me laugh because that's something a lot of people don't know. Have you heard of AMD?
Yeah.
Oh, not AMD. Who am I talking about?
AMD. I'm going to say they're the old chip manufacturer that they were up against Intel, aren't they?
Yeah. Anyway, AMD is run by Lisa Su. That's Jensen Huang's cousin, believe it or not.
Okay.
So, I quite like the idea of family meals, you get around Christmas. Have you met Lisa? Yes, there's Lisa. Yes, I run AMD. And Jensen's like, we know, a little small, tiny company. We control NVIDIA, the most powerful company. But again, the problem is, right, it's not going to be the most valuable company in the world for that long. Yeah. This way, in my view. A lot of people disagree with that and think it was going to go on to just conquer the world, essentially. But it's not bigger than Microsoft.
Just to put it in perspective for our, obviously, US listeners, we have something called the FTSE 100 over here. And the actual market cap valuation of NVIDIA at its peak was worth more than our top 100 companies in the UK. So get your head around that. And also, what was the other fact about it? It's more than our GDP, our gross domestic product. I mean, it's staggering, really, isn't it?
Oh, I don't know. Is it worth more than Canada's entire stock exchange as well at one point? Do you know, like it's...
Probably, yeah. I mean,
madness. Okay.
So what about the wider market? I mean, there was I don't know if you saw the research note from BCA warned that the US stock market could fall by 30% as a recession looms either this year or in early 2025. Chief global strategist Peter Berezin predicts that the S&P 500 could drop to 3750, driven by a significant slowdown in the labor market affecting consumer spending. He also anticipates economic downturn in Europe and China, which could further strain global growth and stocks. The forecast follows a volatile year for the market, with indexes recovering losses from mid-2023 and the S&P 500 currently up 15% year-to-date. What are your thoughts on that one, gents?
Well, I think S&P 500, on average annual return since 1957 has been 11%, right? And within that, there's huge variance. There's been years where it's been down 20, 25, 30%, years where it's gone up 40%. But you're going to have like peaks and troughs in that. Now, the problem with the S&P 500 at the moment is that in the past, it was quite a diversified basket of equities, whereas now almost all the capital gains are being driven by the top sort of 10, 15 shares. And of the top 10 stocks in the S&P 500, 8 of them are really invested heavily and are being driven by this AI bubble. So it's very difficult now with the S&P 500 to look at it and be able to do, I don't know, fundamental research and say this should be worth this amount of money, because it's so dependent on one particular segment, which is, you know, being driven by sentiment. I don't know. I think, you know, in terms of could there be like an economic crash or a downturn? I mean, in America, it tends to be the case that when the Federal Reserve cuts rates, it's doing so in reaction to a weakening economy. Because, for example, if the Fed cut rates now, while there's already massive growth, it could lead to a resurgence in inflation. So they have no incentive to do it. They're only going to do it when it starts to see weakness in the economy. Yeah. And therefore, you know, you're looking at one rate cut this year, or it might not even happen this year, but when the rate cuts do come, you will probably see a downturn for a while. But the problem is that it mixed into all of this is geopolitical instability. And obviously we had Russia invading Ukraine, which, you know, no one really saw coming. But then, you know, the conflict in the Middle East between Israel and Hamas. And then obviously there's this tension simmering between China and Taiwan. And it's so complex, it's very difficult to know where it will go from year to year. The only thing that you do know is that historically it's returned a positive average. If you're taking a very long-term approach, you should be fine. But year to year, you can have bad years.
Would you not think that the... I take your word in terms of the technology, let's not call it a bubble, but technology wrong, if you like, is something that we haven't experienced before. But the PE ratios now on these stocks are getting absurd.
Well, I mean, the PE ratio on Nvidia, I mean, if you look, you know, it has changed quite a lot, actually. But I mean, at the moment, you know, on Google, it's like 72, 73. This isn't that bad compared to like the dot-com bubble. But the problem is, I mean, if you look at like the annual earnings, just hang on 2 seconds. I've got some wonderful statistics. I'm sure I'll be able to find some for you.
We'll come back to that number in a minute, Charles. But do you not think that historically these, you know, recessions and also not, let's call not the recessions, but the crashes that we've had the last couple of them, we obviously had the Lehman downturn in, was it 2007, 2008, which was completely, you know, that was unavoidable, really, wasn't it, in terms of the lending and the subprime and everything. But the last real big crash was COVID, wasn't it, really? 2020, start March of 2020, that was the biggest downturn we saw in the US?
Yeah. Well, you did. I mean, this is the thing. One of the big things that I like learned from analysts who are, you know, potentially way more experienced than me is that when people are predicting a downturn, it tends not to happen. The downturns tend to happen when you're not predicting it. And you can see this in, like you say, the COVID pandemic. That sort of every global index in the world dropped like 30, 35% in the space of a couple of months between February and April 2020, right? But in 2008, Lehman Brothers, whatever, bang, crash, thump, you know, like nobody really thought that was going to happen, minus one or two, you know, Michael Burry and one or two like very clever people. But I think one thing that maybe doesn't concern, maybe isn't the strong word, but something that you were thinking about, Bear Stearns back in 2007, 2008, when it went under, there was a wobble and everything was fine for about 8, 9 months, and Lehman Brothers went under, and then we had the huge 2008 recession. Now, we've had Silicon Valley Bank and then Credit Suisse both go under, and then obviously the big issue with the American regional banks, which is still not resolved. And now everything seems to be fine, and yet I can't help but think, is there a black swan on the horizon? Who knows? History does tend to rhyme, doesn't it, Phil?
Bit, isn't it? And what about the greenback? Have you been waxing lyrical about the dollar, the strength of it, and how amazing?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just amazed with, I mean, I know we're talking to the American audience here and you all believe in this greenback dollar, but the scenario is that surely we understand that if we keep printing more money, then the value of something goes down. Now, that hasn't happened to this point. So, I mean, you were talking about a gold scenario. What was it that you were talking about there in terms of the value of houses in the US?
I was saying that in a lot of areas in the US, the price of housing in gold in many areas in the US is unchanged between that in the past 40 years. Gold has slowly crept up. And what's happened is you've printed so many US dollars, the price of housing in dollars has gone up massively. But actually, in gold terms, it's not changed that much at all for vast swathes of America. Now, the one of the big problems that you have in the US is the debt ceiling. And you keep increasing the debt ceiling. Effectively, the deficit, as in there's not enough tax being collected from American taxpayers, so you're borrowing it in the form of issuing treasuries. At some point, that's going to collapse. We don't know when, but it's going to have to, or there's going to be huge spending cuts. Yeah. I'm not entirely sure what the plan is. It might be central bank.
That would insinuate that gold has held steady in a linear fashion in terms of inflation, whereas the dollar's inflationary numbers have gone absolutely off the charts.
Well, I mean, either this is the problem, though, isn't it, though? Because it depends on how you're measuring dollars, right? Because the dollar isn't just a currency in isolation. You compare it against other currencies, but also in terms of equities, which it's backed by. So if you look at, the S&P 500 is a good example. S&P 500 has massively outperformed gold, and that's backed by the US dollar because it's effectively a reflection of the US economy. So it's a lot more complex than that. I think one of the big lessons you have to learn from it, not investing advice, but you know, anyone would this is, you know, objective advice, is that you can't keep your money in cash. You need to be invested. Now, whether that's in gold, which is relatively safe, and you know, or increasingly cryptocurrencies, which are very unsafe in my view, or you know, a diversified basket of equities, which I think is probably the best bet, then that's fine. But you know, people go, oh, you know, the dollar will be over, the dollar is really weak. That's probably true, but then at the same time, you have to compare it to other currencies. The Swiss franc is extremely strong, but realistically, what's it backed by? Switzerland, which doesn't really have much manpower. You've got, obviously, the British pound, GBP. That's been weakening against the dollar for years, but it's actually quite strong against other currencies in the, you know, in terms of a global scale. Australian dollar, again, there's like, 30 million people living in Australia? That's like nobody. So, you know, it's very easy to go, oh, you know, the US dollar is weak. And it is, they're weakening it. They're printing money, they're weakening it. But at the same time, if the economy grows fast enough to accommodate the extra dollars, then you'll be all right for a time. The real risk is that all those extra dollars in circulation, they kind of get hoovered up by large companies and by individuals and by, you know, governments worldwide. What happens if there's a dumping, if they get dumped? This is the thing, whether it's China dumping their treasuries or companies needing to spend loads of money at the same time. A kind of a nightmare scenario, we were talking about interest rate cuts, is if the Federal Reserve decides to cut interest rates quite drastically to slow down a recession, and then all of the people with loads of US dollars, suddenly they're getting lower, you know, interest on their US dollar balances. They dump the dollars on the market in favor of other commodities or equities. And then you have a huge surplus of dollars while the Fed is cutting rates, and also while there's a recession. Oh, my God, it could be awful. But let's hope not. We're talking about OTC.
It is pretty obvious that we're having a shift into both resource-based economies and BRICS economies, which are one of the same thing. You know, Brazil, Russia, India, China. You've got Egypt joining that. You've got Iran joining that. You've got lots of other smaller countries joining that scenario. And these are going to be resource-backed fiat currencies. You cannot say that about the US. And also, the US has by far the largest deficit.
Yeah,
maybe it doesn't have the largest deficit in terms of its revenue that it can produce, but it is coming to a point where the tax revenues are going to cover how much of the interest payment. You know,
it's going to be a big problem.
And the US actually needs lower interest rates to help itself.
So I mean, for me,
what is the the likely scenario. There has to be an incredibly big deflationary event, you know, what happens?
I mean, the only thing I would say when people say the US isn't backed by anything, it has, you know, easily the largest military in the world. This is the only thing I would say. So if it comes to a point where they feel that they need to do something drastic, then they may. But you are right, Kev. I look at the dollar and I just, since they decoupled from the gold standard, that's the issue. It's as simple as that. You can just create, whenever there's a problem, and it's not just the US, it's all over the Western world, you just print money to deal with it. And we were seeing the effects of that now in terms of incredibly high house pricing, jobs with wages that aren't keeping up with the cost of living, people not having children because they can't afford to have them. And all of these kind of like hard factors in the economy are going to create much bigger problems going forward. But there seems to be no political will to deal with it.
So, America, is it sensible that you diversify some of your assets into a non-US-based currency, into resource-type plays, which we've discussed? Gold and metal resources, yes, it's on UK soil, but ultimately they're going to be backed by a resource, which if something happens to the US dollar, the price of tungsten is going to just continue to rocket. Price of gold could rocket, price of copper could rocket in US dollar terms, and therefore protecting your wealth. Yeah. What hear you say, Charles Archer?
I would say that's not too shabby of an idea. I mean, the other thing to bear in mind is that cyclically, junior resource sector, whether you're in the UK or elsewhere, is kind of at its bottom in terms of the cycle if you compare to past parcel of bumps and peaks. So yes, I think it's a decent way to diversify within a larger portfolio.
Yeah, and right now you're probably getting good bang for your buck, literally, to go and buy to the UK stock market that is beaten down to oblivion, basically.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, definitely. We've got very good value on UK stocks, OTC.
You're talking about PE values of possibly less than 5 in some of these producing assets.
Yeah, yeah. Madness. They should be much, much higher. But people are all chasing the AI dream at the moment. When that bubble pops, they're all going to come to this sector.
Yeah, let's hope so.
Yeah.
Okay, now I think we've talked long enough. Let's wrap up. Obviously, we say thanks to Oliver Friesen from Guardian Meta Resources. And if you like what you've heard and you want to sort of check the company out, they're trading under the ticker GMTLF. Also, if you like what you've heard in terms of the podcast content, please subscribe. And we'll be going out on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. So hit the bell icon for any future notifications of any further episodes. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, guys.